ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At 17, Chantelle McDougall was nannying for a 36-year-old man. At 20, she was pregnant with his child and swept up in his bizarre spiritual beliefs. At 27, they all disappeared.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions, no matter what.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of control, manipulation and isolation. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman, it's a slightly personal question on national radio. It's about MDMA, what people might know as ecstasy.
Is that what they call pingers?
Yes, that is a term that people would use.
Right.
It can come in various forms. And yes, I think people might be aware of it in the recreational sense, but there is actually medical MDMA, very carefully dosed, that is being used for some people with PTSD. It's MDMA-assisted psychotherapy.
Yeah, it started with US veterans and they were going down to Mexico, I think it was, to have their MDMA and they claimed benefit, and it's grown from there.
Mm. And there's a lot of attention in the media. The question is there evidence? What are the potential harms? Do we know enough yet? And there are people receiving it in Australia as we speak.
And Australia was the first country in the world to approve the use of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy.
There's a lot of work going on in the background and a lot more research happening in the space. And that is something we are covering on today's Health Report.
I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
And I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land. Also on the show, there's a lot of stuff for parents and caregivers to remember, including childhood routine vaccines. Could SMS reminders with a personal touch be the solution to kids getting vaccinated on time?
And a really radical story, which is, should doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists and others measure how well or badly their patients are doing? You think they do that, but the allegation is they might not be doing it particularly well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people assume that perhaps they are being measured with very clear objective measurements, but not always the case.
And in news, Priya?
There's a study that's been published in JAMA Pediatrics, which looks at a topic close to my heart, daily screen use in children and adolescents and whether it impacts sleep.
So I'll bet everybody listening to this will make an assumption because they take the phones away from their child so that they're not sleeping with the phone in the room and they're trying to monitor screen time. It becomes yet another parenting piece of angst. What influence do screens have on childhood or adolescent sleeping?
This is one systematic review and meta-analysis.
Well, it's a pretty big one.
It is.
And probably the biggest to date. It's not like one little trial for 20 kids, you know.
I think we may disagree here. I have a feeling.
You just want to know that screens are bad for your kids.
No, well, there's 25 studies, which has just included over 4,500 participants.
Yes.
They've looked at, within an individual, changes that might occur with screen use.
And just to explain that a bit further, is that a lot of studies will compare groups of children. So one group of children's having X amount of screen time, another group of children's having Y screen time. And these researchers, who are mostly Australian researchers actually, decided that maybe the more relevant comparison is in the individual child because they become their own control. So when screen use changes, goes up, goes down, comes later or whatever, does that sleep change in that particular young person?
They've included children aged 3 to 25. That's the age range. So I think a very hot target age range that a lot of people, their ears are pricking up. And what they've found, the conclusion, is that screen time might delay the bedtime. They've actually said that people might be on their screens and it might push back the bedtime and actually sacrifice some sleep. But there didn't appear to be a really significant detrimental impact on sleep quality.
Or sleep duration.
Yes. And yet, if you look at sleep hygiene guidelines, Norman, they all talk about no screens and bright lights in the hour before bed.
True. But what they did find was that if a child or a young person were to go on the screen after their bedtime or after they're supposed to be asleep, that did actually interrupt their sleep. So this is screen time during the day, largely during the day, in fact, but also just before bed as well. And what they found was that it kind of averaged out. If you looked over an average period of time, kids' sleep time was not affected, nor was sleep latency. In other words, there were not taking longer to go to sleep than they otherwise would have. So it does contradict the received wisdom here and of course, the moral panic about screens.
I think we need to acknowledge that most of the studies included were in Western societies. It was a predominantly Caucasian population, so perhaps it can't be applied across the globe or generalised. But, you know, I still bang on about sleep hygiene in the clinic. I will continue to. And I have to say I'm quite onto this as a parent. I'm not, I based on this, Norman, I will probably remain the same as a parent. Is that fair?
Absolutely fair.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Also in the realm of children, in JAMA there's been a study that's looked at pain relief in children who have had a non-operative limb injury.
So they've hurt their arm or they've hurt their leg.
Yes, might be a fracture without an operation.
So a lot of pain.
So normally first line for that is an anti-inflammatory, what people might know as ibuprofen or brand name Nurofen. The question that these researchers have asked is if we add something like hydromorphone, which is an opioid, or paracetamol to the ibuprofen, does it make the pain management better for the child?
And what they showed was no. Ibuprofen itself.
Oh, you say that's another pronunciation.
How do you pronounce it? I say tomato.
Ibuprofen.
Ibuprofen.
Please write in, friends. Tell us who's right. It's definitely me. It's
bloody Australians. There's a lot of scepticism about paracetamol for various kinds of pain. It works in some kinds of pain really well, but others not. And musculoskeletal pain seems to be one category of pain. That's actually Australian research suggests that it's not that effective. And opioids, there actually, surprisingly, there's not a lot of evidence of the benefits of opioids over standard anti-inflammatories. And here they had four times the number of side effects if they took opioids.
I think that it's really helpful, a study like this, but it doesn't include operative injuries, unfortunately. So I think there are a lot of people who would be doing, you know, I'm thinking of my husband who'd be going, I'd love to know what this result is in kids who've had surgical intervention. But I think you're right, you can potentially minimise side effects and reduce cost. Ibuprofen is probably the way to go.
And a study that got a lot of publicity during the week, which is probably just mentioned in passing, and also there is an ABC News and ABC Science summary of that study, which we can refer to and give you a link to in our show notes, which is a study suggesting that multivitamins might slow the ageing process, but there are a few buts.
There are a few buts, and I just think of Brian Johnson when I see studies like this. Do you know who I'm talking about?
$2 million a year.
Yes.
Multi-supplement.
Is going to live forever. And people weaponise studies like this to sell their supplements which lack evidence.
If you want to know more about Brian Johnson, there's a Watch That Rash on it not so long ago. And we'll have links to that in our show notes as well.
This was a randomised controlled trial which has looked at 958 adults aged 60 and older.
On average 70 actually, which yes. is quite important to the study.
And they've looked at what they call their epigenetic clocks, which is the chemical changes on their DNA which give you a sign of biological ageing. Do you like that explanation, Norman?
It's very good. It's much shorter than mine. I'm very impressed. We'd have been here till next Thursday or Friday to explain it.
I saved the listeners 2 minutes, but it's really looking at that really DNA level of biological age. What they've done is they've randomised these nearly, you know, mean age 70-year-olds into taking this multivitamin every single day for 2 years.
And a cocoa supplement with flavonoids.
Or, so you could either take the multivitamin or cocoa or take both or take nothing. So that's the four groups. And they've looked at them over 2 years and what they've found is that in the multivitamin group, two of the biological clocks that they were looking at, and they were looking at a total of five, two of them appeared to show that there was less biological ageing.
And it seemed to be in people with more rapid ageing before they entered the study than others. So just a little bit more on these epigenetic clocks.
Here we go. Strap in, friends. Norman, I love your explanations.
I'm ignoring the insults that are flowing from Melbourne along the lines to Sydney. So these epigenetic clocks are controversial because they have to be calibrated against the real world of people's ageing. And in fact, one of the most reliable ones is actually the one that comes out of New Zealand, which is the Dunedin clock, which closely ties into the Dunedin study where they've been following large number of people from very early in their lives through, I think at the moment, to their 40s and 50s. So that one is well calibrated. But the others, the calibrations, in other words, does it really tie into real life is a question. So people interviewed for this article in the ABC Science News article like Luigi Fontana, who's an expert in this area, says it really doesn't tie down multivitamins to slowing aging. And you don't really need multivitamins if you're eating something like the Mediterranean diet. And even the authors of the study agree with that.
Yes. The authors have said take this with a grain of salt. It's not in all the biological clocks that we've tested. And they've certainly said not to run out and go and buy a multivitamin. Are you going to go and take a multivitamin, Norman, as a result?
Not on your Nelly.
Not on your Nelly. That's my answer too. If you'd like to check out the ABC Health story on this, you can head to the ABC Health News page, or you can check out our show notes if you'd like to see the link.
That's abc.net.au/news/health.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Health Report.
So the next story is about, you know, something you hear a lot about, probably not that common in the system, but it'll probably become commoner, which is the use of psychedelics in therapy, but particularly the use of MDMA, and it's MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. Have you had any patients go through that?
I have not. I think we need to be clear, it's not a common course of therapy for people with PTSD, and you'll hear in the interview that it is reserved for a select group, and there are certainly other evidence-based strategies for the management of PTSD.
And the interesting thing here is that US veterans with PTSD noticed that if they took ecstasy, they felt better, and then it developed from there. But in fact, we in Australia were the first country in the world to approve it for use. And it's very important that it's not MDMA by itself, it's MDMA with psychotherapy. And the question is, how's it going in Australia? What's the evidence base? And you and I spoke to Associate Professor Jill Beatty, who's Head of Substance Use Research at Orygen at the University of Melbourne. So, Jill, thanks for joining Priya and I on The Health Report. It's really nice of you to come on. Before we start, a recent review, or relatively recent, last couple of years, of the evidence for MDMA on PTSD, the evidence is pretty, to be blunt, crap.
Yeah. Yes, that is a good characterisation of it. I mean, it's very promising evidence, but it's early evidence. So I think people have got very, very enthusiastic, particularly with the media interest and the hype that's happened. We have really ended up viewing the evidence as if it is more solid than it actually is. What we have here is a pretty small evidence base. So far, around about 330 people have been through clinical trials using MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. The majority of that has been for PTSD, but that's still a pretty small number. The other thing that I guess has happened is that we've become a bit more aware of some of the methodological issues that have risen in this space. And some of them are pretty obvious, like the fact that it's actually really hard to blind a substance like MDMA. So,
because I already have a psychedelic experience, yeah. So you don't.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bunch of work happening at the moment to try and see if there are ways of having an active control, for instance, that mimics the effects enough that we would then be able to have a double-blinded study. Essentially, we don't currently have any double-blinded studies. We have studies that are called double-blinded, but when you read them closely, the vast majority of participants know what they had. And that's important.
What about the side effects, Jill, in terms of, I know there are shorter-term side effects, but what about the longer term? Do we have a good idea of what that looks like?
Unfortunately, Priya, we don't. So we actually conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis a couple of years looking at this exact problem. And what we found is that when we looked at the existing data, we had a range of side effects that seemed pretty reassuring. They were things we kind of already knew about MDMA. So they're things like temperature issues, so feeling cold or excessive perspiration, feeling jittery, nausea, that sort of thing. What we haven't seen, though, is good, high-quality evidence. And that's partially because the studies to date have stopped at the end of treatment. So we don't yet have any long-term evidence. The treatment normally lasts for about 3 months. We measure the outcome at 3 months. We measure the side effects up to 3 months. And then we don't have any high-quality studies that actually follow through all of the participants for longer periods.
So you followed up with presumably psychologists, psychiatrists, researchers, and people who'd gone through this treatment in a kind of qualitative way. What did you find?
So that was actually a study that was led by researchers from the from Monash University. There was a range of different views. A lot of the clinicians felt that it was very important to have really comprehensive screening and very detailed consent processes and a lot of processes in place to try and safeguard as best as possible the well-being of participants. the need for patients to consider things like financial impacts of the treatment because it's very expensive. And they also highlighted the fact that this shouldn't be viewed as a separate treatment. It should really be viewed as something that should integrate with the broader treatment of patients.
Jill, how do people access it? And do we have a rough idea of how many clinicians are prescribing this therapy and how many patients have actually received it? Do we have a good idea on numbers?
I have an idea on numbers, but I've heard this kind of anecdotally through different sources, so it's probably not 100% accurate. It is quite hard to access this treatment.
So hold on a second, just before you go on, because it's an important question that Priya's asked, but just before you go on, you'd assume that the powers that be, if they're going to approve this assisted psychotherapy, you'd have a register.
So and you'd have to have additional training as well, I thought, the clinician.
I mean, that's what the Swedes do. If you don't have a randomised trial, you do a register. So we've clunked our way to approval with no proper monitoring.
The TGA has a register, so they know how many people. And my understanding is that there's approximately 30 clinicians who are authorised prescribers now across the country. And my understanding is that we have had about 190 people go through either MDMA-assisted psychotherapy or psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy. In relation to a register, one of the problems is that the TGA is not, as far as I understand it, can't actually mandate a registry of data. There is a registry that exists at ANU, but that is voluntary. And so one of the things that we really would love to see is some way of mandating that so that we actually get a full and comprehensive picture of the evidence.
And what about consumers? What were their responses?
Consumers varied a lot. So what we're hearing anecdotally, and this is not from that study that was published, is that a small group of people who go through this treatment have difficulties afterwards.
Such as?
It's increase in suicidality, it's functional problems, and a sense that they've sort of had can of worms opened that they then have to deal with afterwards.
And none of the studies have looked beyond that 3-month mark in terms of side effects yet.
There are some follow-up studies that were done on the phase 3 studies, but what we've seen is that it was only a subset of people who they managed to follow up, and the ones who started off more poorly were less likely to follow up. It's essentially a biased sample of people at that point.
One of your conclusions was that it's got to be expectation management, and presumably that's expectation management on the part of the doctor or the psychologist and indeed the person going through it. What do you mean? That you come into it thinking it's going to cure your PTSD, but it actually might not? What's the story there?
This is a huge issue. The reason for that is the way that the media has dealt with this. What's happened is that there's been a huge amount of hype and a lot of people have a sense of kind of desperation about their chances of succeeding in different treatments. By the time people get to something like MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, they've typically tried a range of different treatments. People have heard these things about these kind of miraculous cures. And so I think there are some really problematic preconceptions that people have about what this treatment is going to be like, how likely they are to have a full recovery from it, and also what the potential sort of downsides might be. This is not a magic bullet. It's work. You know, it's like any psychotherapy. It takes a lot of effort. And it may or may not produce the kind of results that they want.
And that it's not standalone, that this is really kind of part of a much bigger picture that requires ongoing therapy and input. It's not just the psychotherapy session with MDMA assistance. This is a part of a much bigger picture.
Definitely. It is an intensive process. So typically there would be sort of 2 to 3 sessions with MDMA, but then there would be a series of sessions in the lead up to that. Then there's also a really important piece after the sessions, which is about generalising what's happened in the sessions into their day-to-day life.
And presumably nobody's done a head-to-head with, say, reconsolidation therapy, where you flush out the symptoms of PTSD and then you try and block them. Presumably there's nothing head-to-head to compare the two.
No, and that's one of the issues with the psychotherapy that's been run to date is that the psychotherapy itself that's been used in studies is not an evidence-based treatment.
So bottom line for people listening who might have PTSD?
Bottom line is this is not a first-line treatment. This is not a magic bullet. It can be useful for some people, but it requires a lot of careful thought, particularly given the costs and potentially unknown risk-benefit profile.
Have we just introduced this too early?
My view, and you know, I think the view of a lot of people in this field when the TGA rescheduled MDMA and psilocybin, was that it was too early. in some ways, the costs and the difficulty of sort of accessing this has actually worked as a bit of a brake on it being sort of introduced willy-nilly. Because as we see it use increase, as we see more people coming into the treatment, we're going to see more rare side effects. And given that these side effects are not things that we would necessarily see from other types of treatments, things like what they call ontological shock, which is like the idea of breaking down what one understands about reality, but for some people it can persist. And so that's something that I think we need to understand. We need to understand what the risk factors are, who is more likely to have these kinds of experiences. And then we need to be able to point them in the right direction for treatment. And at the moment, we don't have any of that information.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. It's very nice to talk to you.
Associate Professor Jill Beatty, who is the head of substance use research at Origin.
So one hopes that the evidence gets a bit better as time goes on.
Sounds like there's a lot of research happening in the space. And yeah, I guess let's see what the longer term effects are. And
you still need a lot of moolah to pay for it. You're with the Health Report here on ABC Radio National.
On to vaccination, a very important topic. And we have covered on the show several times that vaccine rates in children are declining in some age groups, and that is a serious problem when we think about whooping cough or pertussis and measles. And life gets very busy as a parent. I have my hand up here, Norman. You might remember those days when your children are due for routine scheduled vaccines. And the question...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to explain, most people are not anti-vax or even vaccine hesitant. They just forget. They're busy.
Yes, you get busy. And you go, wow, my child is suddenly 18 months and what, I have to get vaccinations again? So the question is, would SMS reminders help? And if the answer is yes, what kind of SMS? Is it one with a personal touch? Does it have an element about protecting your child, the community, or is it just a get vaccinated, you're due kind of thing? There's a study that has looked at this, and we spoke to Tom Snelling, who is a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney and an author on the study.
So although Australia has always enjoyed quite high vaccine coverage for routine childhood vaccines over the past few years, the coverage has been slipping a little bit. And we need very high vaccine coverage to stop transmission of things like measles. And so even just small improvements in vaccine coverage can help to ensure that if measles does come into Australia, that it is effectively controlled and doesn't spread in the community. And we've been able to show that text message reminders are a very cheap, simple and easy way of achieving improvements in coverage.
What did you do in the study?
So we worked with GP clinics across Australia to send out text message reminders to parents of kids who were registered with their practice at about the time that their vaccine doses were due. And we tested a number of different types of message, and we tested a number of different timings of the message in relation to when the vaccine dose was due. And then we used software that was embedded within their practice to find out when those children, if and when they came and had their doses. And by doing that, we were able to work out whether the messages were effective and how effective they were compared to sending no message. And we were also able to look at the relative effectiveness of different types of message on timeliness of vaccination.
So when you say types of message, what do you mean? Because there's just the standard time for your vaccines and then there's the message that has a personal element. Can you talk us through the types of different messages that were sent and which one was most effective?
All of our messages were addressed as coming from the GP or from the practice, and we think that was probably an important part of the success. And then some of the messages were just neutral reminders. All they did was state that the child was due their vaccine dose when it was due and provided a phone number for the parent to contact the clinic to make the appointment. And they were quite effective. But we also looked at messages where we had some persuasive element to the message. So some of the messages had a positive framing, so they were really encouraging vaccination as being good for the child. We also tried messages that were framed in a more risk-averse sense, so warning about the risks of not vaccinating on time, And we also tried messages that spoke to the community benefit of making sure that kids receive their vaccine doses.
So what worked best?
Just sending any message seems to be the thing that has most of the effect, but it appeared as though some of the persuasive messages performed better than just a simple neutral reminder, whether it was a positively framed or what we call a pro-social framed message around the community benefit of vaccination. Those messages appeared as though they might actually work better than just a neutral reminder.
And what about timing? I mean, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning when you're at work or driving
the kids
to school.
How many weeks before the vaccine? Because you've got to plan these things.
So we expected, based on our discussions with parents, that giving the messages at least 2 weeks before the vaccine dose was due would be most effective. So we tested that and we compared it with just sending a message on the day that the vaccine dose was due. And we also tested that against a strategy where we only sent the messages if a child had not received their vaccine 7 days after it was due. And what we found out was actually they were pretty much the same. They were all effective strategies. With sending the message after it's due and only to those parents whose kids are not yet vaccinated, we were sending out many fewer messages because, in fact, especially for the early vaccine doses, most parents do get their babies vaccinated very quickly. Even doing that, the strategy seemed to be just as good, just as effective as if we messaged everyone ahead of the due date.
Tom, who foots the bill for this at the moment? Is it the GP clinic? Is the federal government funding it? Who pays?
So at the moment, GP practices are paying to send out messages. The messages themselves are very cheap, only a few cents for a text message. So it's not actually a big cost.
But does it take much time from the practice manager's life or the practice nurse?
Once a practice decides to do this, it can be set up in a practice to occur automatically without much input or need from practice staff to have to do it manually.
Is this going to make a material difference to vaccination rates?
Even relatively small incremental improvements in vaccine timeliness, we're potentially looking at 6 percentage point, even up to a 10 percentage point improvement in some routine childhood vaccines and the timeliness of those vaccines. And even though they seem relatively modest, they can have a disproportionate effect on transmission of infections.
Tom Snelling is professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. I mean, this notion that you pay for texts does my head in a bit.
My clinic recently ran out of credit. It was eye-opening to me. I went, oh, we actually pay for this to text patients.
What were they doing on your American Express card, really?
No. There's a very complex way that GP funding works, I guess, billing. But someone is wearing the cost. And I think if this is potentially a way to improve the vaccination rates and have timely vaccination of children, shouldn't the government be funding it? Do you think?
Definitely. Always. Definitely.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
Here's a radical thought for you, Priya. Measuring the outcomes of care of your patients. You probably think you do it already.
I do. And to be fair, we do this a lot. But I think the next story is talking about it in a much more objective, careful manner.
Systematic way. Mm. It's the idea of measurement-based care, is that extending what doctors, psychologists, other health professionals would do, which is how are you going, how are your symptoms in a given area, taking
notes. For mental health, to be specific.
But this is for mental health, is if you actually were to measure things objectively and comparing to last time and helping yourself along digitally, could you actually improve care and perhaps even save lives? And one of the people researching this area is Frankie Orfino, who is an associate professor at the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney.
Part of what we're interested in is the kind of systematic use of measurement-based care across the mental health system. And unfortunately, a lot of studies do show that not everyone is doing it, at least not to some protocol.
What does it look like, Frank? Is it using validated questionnaires? Is it particular tools? What are we actually talking about when we say measurement-based care?
So it looks like a person might present for mental health care and they'll be asked to download maybe an app or a tool, or sometimes it's paper-based. But then week to week or day to day, sometimes they might be filling out a questionnaire or scales which rates various things, mental health symptoms, their functioning, sleep, other kinds of vital signs of mental health. And so then a clinician would see that information. Sometimes the person sees it themselves. And that's then used to decide and look at, are they improving? Are they on a stable trajectory? Are they getting worse? And then you're using that information to guide decisions about treatment.
Self-rated?
Often self-rated, yep. A big part of it does rely on self-report. But we're seeing expansion into other kinds of tracking devices. And this is why it's an interesting topic at the moment, for me at least. It's, digital technologies are changing what it is we can track, how often we can track these things. The use of wearables and other things mean that we can expand this kind of tracking and monitoring into things like sleep and activity, and how do those feed into an understanding about mental health.
Can you just give us a practical idea of how this might play out?
So if we're tracking outcomes over time, what it enables is a much more detailed understanding about someone's illness trajectory. And so, for example, we did some work a few years ago where we were monitoring suicide ideation among young people using a measurement-based care platform. And what we showed was that among those who reported suicide ideation, their trajectories were highly variable and hard to predict with just a single snapshot in time. But using repeat measurement and measurement-based care over time, we could use this information to learn something about a person's unique pattern and what this means for them going into the future. So, for example, you might have person A and person B. They're both on the same level of suicide ideation when you last see them. Let's say, it's in the low range. But because of the learned trajectory using measurement-based care, the model that we developed was making very different predictions for person A and person B. For person A, they had followed a very volatile trajectory, ups and downs, right up the range of suicide ideation. And so despite being at the same level as person B, I might want to follow them up more routinely, maybe every few days, and maybe I need to try a different treatment approach because clearly there's a lot of ups and downs.
So you can risk stratify better, safety net better.
That's right.
Yeah. Project the outcome.
Yeah. And then just quickly with person B, same level, but the learned trajectory has been, they started at a moderate level. They've been improving over time. So you could conclude the treatment approach seems to be working, and maybe once every 2 weeks or even once every month might be okay because the model was saying, I have high confidence that this range or this score is going to still be in this low range into the future. And so that's what we can enable with new AI and machine learning. When we start to track things over time, you get much richer information about people's mental health.
Let me be clear on what the problem is you're trying to solve. I mean, if you're not doing this, or you're doing it in a kind of casual, non-systematic way, how are you going this week? Are you sleeping better? Blah, blah, blah. And you make a few rough notes. Is there a significant difference in terms of the benefit for the person in having it done systematically and broadly?
It does have a strong evidence base that when measurement-based care is done kind of using a tool and systematically, you see greater symptom reduction, particularly for those who aren't doing well, and also increased rates of remission and reduced relapse. So when it's done well and it's used systematically, it can be very effective, and there's a strong evidence base that supports it. But yeah, on the contrary, when you're not tracking things routinely or you're relying on clinical judgment, we know that these things can fail at times and fail to pick up subtle differences or changes. The busyness of practice gets in the way. And so by having a tool that can really be used to monitor these things routinely, it can really enhance the quality of care.
Do we know why people aren't using it clinically? You just mentioned that clinic can get busy. Do clinicians know about this? Do they know about the kinds of things that patients have at the tips of their fingers on their wearables? Is there enough known about it in the community?
I think so. And most, if we're talking about psychologists, but also psychiatrists, people do this and it's in your training. But I think once we get into the real world, things then take over. There's lots of admin.
Sorry, I don't think apps and wearables are part of training of a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist. I mean, you struggle to get a psychiatrist to use a computer. I mean, come on.
Maybe I was being a bit generous there.
Yeah, so let's be real.
the idea of monitoring outcomes, you know, it seems like it, of course, that's what we're doing. But then I think things get, busy admin. People often feel also like there's data overload too. They don't want to rely on or reduce mental health down to just simply a number or a score. And I can completely understand.
They like the vibe. They want the vibe.
Yeah, it's the vibe. You know, I can generally tell that someone's improved or, and clinical judgment is an important factor in terms of guiding care decisions. But I kind of view it as just another piece of information to tell the whole story about someone's, care journey and are they improving.
Is this, Frank, though, people with their app on their phone or their watch, whatever it is, logging into something every day and maybe doing a quick questionnaire on their mood, the wearable throwing out their sleep quality and, their heart rate variability and whatever else, them coming into an appointment with psychologist, psychiatrist, GP, whoever it is, and providing the information? Is it that this might all happen outside the consulting room, but it gets given to the clinician who then tracks it as a way to project where we're headed or if we're actually improving?
That's pretty accurate, I think. And I think at a very basic level, that's what we should at least be doing, is tracking things from session to session and bringing that into the session and using that information to guide care decisions. But digital technologies are transforming how we can monitor things day to day, capture mood, as you said, but also these passive data sensors to not only just understand outcomes, but also understand a person's lived experience and their experience of mental health away from the clinic. As you know, we don't have a test for mental health. We don't have a brain scan or a biomarker. So we rely on self-report.
So what about the differences between people? I mean, I'll come to the issue in a minute about whether psychologists and psychiatrists actually trust what people are saying to them as valid. But you do have people on a spectrum, and one of them is extroversion, introversion. So extroversion is somebody who's outgoing, and introversion is, ingoing. And there's also an element of what they would call neuroticism. I don't want to use that word disparagingly, but there are people who are more symptom aware and symptom concerned than other people when it goes on that personality scale. Mm-hmm. How do you adjust for that? Or is it just that if I'm feeling that, it's real and you've got to deal with it? Sorry.
Yeah, and some of our work does show about who's likely to engage with these kinds of tools. And there is an element of, let's call it like health anxiety, where they are more likely to do these scales over time because they're more preoccupied and anxious about their health. So they're more likely to do this self-report.
Could that make it worse?
Well, a lot of the evidence shows that tracking doesn't make things worse and it actually can be therapeutic. And a lot of the concerns that we hear are that there's a worry about too much tracking can lead to too many actions required of a health system to respond to that. So I think you're touching on one potential concern. We do have to be careful about over-tracking and over-monitoring. I think that is a concern that we need to keep an eye on, but I think we're at the other end of the spectrum at the moment where we aren't really doing enough of it.
So I think at this point we need a declaration of whether there's a conflict of interest. I mean, are you making your own digital monitor here that you're going to flog on the market? We just need to be sure.
We've done lots of work over the past decade with one particular platform. That's part of our work. We work with them, but there are many out there that do similar things. So it's not about flogging one particular thing. It is more
so
about
the kind of
approach.
And how would a consumer, in this case with a mental health issue, question to ask the person who's looking after you is, how do we measure me, how I'm going on a day-by-day basis?
That's exactly right. And part of what we tried to do with one of these recent pieces that we wrote was about trying to change some of this culture and I think let people know that this is part of what good mental health care looks like. You should be tracking outcomes. And if you're not, then ask your health professional, ask your clinician if you should start doing that. I think it's about trying to raise awareness about this being a part of a quality marker of good mental health care.
That was Frank Iofino, who is an associate professor with the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney.
Have we got a mailbag this week, Priya?
We do. We always have a mailbag, Norman. I suspect the next week's mailbag will be even bigger. with announcements about Norman and Bad Bunny and other things. Okay, we've had Chris write in saying salt is only bad for less than half the population.
Big call.
Big call. I don't agree, Chris, but let's get further into this email.
Well, before he goes on, I mean, it's true that some people are more salt sensitive than others in terms of your blood pressure.
No matter how much water I drink, if I don't have enough salt, it just goes through. I don't have POTS, but I got very close to a diagnosis. I only thought of salt as bad, but it turns out for many of us it's critical and we have to take it as a supplement.
So it's true. Some people are salt sensitive in both directions, but, you know.
Most of us consume too much salt. And as we heard on the interview last week when we talked about salt intake in kids, even without a change in blood pressure, it is potentially leading to the stiffening of those arteries and the processes that the interview explained. But look, yes, between individuals there is some variation. Is that fair, Norman?
Yes.
Okay. What does Jill write in and say?
She says, hi, Norman.
Oh, just a Norman.
Hi, Jill. Hi. Thanks for writing. You made a comment at the end of the health report. I'm going to have people quote it back to me because there's actually people listening. God, about not drinking hot orange juice. It was actually, I think, more hot lemon juice, but it was hot citrus anyway, as it's poison for your teeth. I have friends for whom this is a daily morning ritual, and I'm pleased to say they're still alive and kicking with no noticeable lack of teeth. But could you please explain why they should perhaps rethink this? Thanks, Jill. I think thanks, Jill. Yeah. Well, it's just what dentists tell me is that when you heat up citric acid, it really goes for your teeth, particularly aligned with sugar. So maybe it's only sugar juices, so on. So we'd welcome some comments from
anyone. Hot orange is unusual.
It might be the combination of hot citric with sugar. And we look forward to continuing this debate with our thousands of dental
listeners. Write in, help us, please, because neither of us are teeth experts. We also have an email from Jamie who says, dear Health Report team, thanks for a great show as always. Thank you, Jamie. We'd love a compliment. Sounds like Norman is engaging in a bit of exposure and response prevention with the toothbrushing. Keep it up.
I fully intend to. I'm not quite sure what I'm keeping up with, but I'll keep it up. Thanks for that email, Jamie.
Please do write in, particularly the dentist next week. We'd love your input. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash? Where this week we're looking at the extent to which headphones might damage your hearing.
Do you wear headphones?
Yeah, I use the little pod things that go in your ears.
No, I use these big ones that we're wearing now.
You need to listen to What's That Rash.
They changed my life. I will. Okay, I'll see you next week then with different headphones.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.